Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Poet, novelist, academic and 10th generation winery owner, Piero Mastroberardino is a modern-day Renaissance man. Passionate about the wines of his native Campania, he's a fascinating source of information about the best local varieties. Terroir, one of the coolest grape-growing regions in Italy, the ancient vineyards of Pompeii, and the legacy of his father Antonio, the so-called grape archaeologist. Hello, Piero, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello. It's my pleasure to be here.
Just tell us where you are. I mean, you're a lucky man. You're near Naples, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm close to Naples. That is such a beautiful city, but I'm on the mountainside. It's a little different from, you know, the beautiful colors and noise of the city. Here we are on the mountains, sheep and nature and trees and so on, but not this density of population. It's a little different.
Yeah, I mean, Naples is a chaotic city, isn't it? God, I mean...
It's just beautiful. It's a theater. You know, everything happens there. On the mountains, you start, you know, having a different approach to life, contemplating, you know, the sun, sunset, and things like that. It's different.
That's good to be. Tell us a little bit about your family, because the Mastroberardino family, I think you've been in wine since, what, the early 1700s, according to the papers in your museum. Just tell us, do you know much about those early days, what they were making?
Oh, yeah, that's a long story. I'm now representing the 10th generation in the wine business of the same family, in the same region, in the same house, because the family headquarter was here 3 centuries ago. This building where I'm now was bought by my family in 1747, but the company, the family business was already there. And the family started the beginning of 1700 making a plan of purchases of land. They were small landowners, and then during the 1700 and the beginning of 1800s, they became a little bigger landowners because of the investments of these my ancestors that became more and more important. And then there is a turning point that is very important in the mid-1800s, because there's my great-grandfather Angelo that was a very visionary man, a pioneer. And he started thinking at agriculture not only as a patrimony, but as a firm, as a business. And he started having the idea of exploring foreign markets. Things were changing at that time because, you know, in the 70s of 1800s, France and Piedmont were attacked by phylloxera. And so there was a huge opportunity for the rest of Italy to go through the European markets and to start bringing the wines from other regions to the international wine contest. We got many diplomas and medals. You know, of these contests made in London, in Paris, you know, at the time.
And, at that time, yeah. It's exactly what happened with Spain, isn't it? That Spain was behind France in terms of phylloxera. And so, you know, but obviously phylloxera got there in the end, really. Tell us a bit about your father, Antonio, because he took over the winery at a difficult time, didn't he? I think he was 17 years old in 1945 after the war, and the Germans, had used the winery as a headquarters at some point. What sort of shape was the winery in when he took over?
Well, consider that my father was born in 1928. So in considering the 20s, my grandfather Michele was able to bring the wines of Irpinia, of my family, in all the continents. So it was a kind of a global vision of wine business. So my father grew up in a very healthy and wealthy condition of the family business. And so he was used to seeing his father, you know, going on the Alps in France to ski, you know, have a beautiful life. Then when the war arrived, everything was just destroyed. And so at the end of the war, when he was just 17, he had this will of, you know, bringing back to the successes of the of his childhood, the wines of the family. So he had a strength, a motivation, a determination to this goal that was just, you know, out of any scale. That's why he was able to bring back to the success the wines of the family in the late 50s and 60s with Taurasi, and then of course in the 70s with Fiano di Avellino and Greco di Tufo. It was a hard work, but you know, my father was a really hard-headed man from the mountains.
Well, he, you know, he's known as the great archaeologist. I mean, you know, he was a very important figure, not just in the history of the south of Italy, but in the history of Italian wine generally. I mean, which grape varieties did he excavate? Did he rescue, if you like?
Well, consider that Hespi Loxera in this region in southern Italy arrived very late in the 30s of 1900s. And then in the late 30s, we had the first big economic issues with the autarchy in Italy. And then we got the World War II. So we got three big events that hit strongly the economy and social life as well. So my father had to, you know, struggle to fight to bring back this patrimony of viticulture, because it was destroyed, because people during the war, of course, went to the war and they abandoned the vineyards. Phylloxera, in the meantime, made some damages. So he was in charge of this huge, huge project of replantation of Fiano grape that was almost disappearing, of Greco and Aglianico that were still quite strong but were hit by this situation. So the vineyards were in a very bad condition. And he had against him and against his thoughts the school at the time, university research people, because they wanted to go through, you know, much more productive varieties that were more affordable on the markets, because the markets were down, economy was down. And so at the time he was really strong, because he said, we have a patrimony and at some point economy will go up again, and we cannot afford to lose this heritage of this huge, you know, 1,000-year heritage of great varietals. And so this was his war, his personal war against the world. And at the end, that's why he was named the grape archaeologist for this reason.
Well, and which grape varieties were they telling him to plant? Trebbiano or things like that, or what?
There were two main trajectories. One was based on the big yield Italian traditional grape varietals. There were Trebbiano and Sangiovese. We had some Trebbiano, we had some Sangiovese in that period in this region. And the other approach was the international varietals that were already, you know, spreading around and that were much more productive and also had an early ripening period, so less risky in terms of, you know, harvest.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder what it was like taking over from your dad. I mean, because did you always think you'd go into the family business? Because, you know, you've had a very varied career yourself. You studied economics, you know, and you did further scientific research in social sciences, things like that. Did you ever think you would just be an academic? Because you're still an academic now. You're a professor. Did you ever think, I don't want to do wine or not?
No, really. I mean, it was something very natural. As we live in the winery, and you know, the next generation, the 11th generation, has the same approach. They live
These
in the
your
winery.
Kids, your two daughters, right?
Yeah, my two daughters. And we smell the fermentation during harvest that comes all the way up to our bedrooms. But it's, you know, something that you got in your nose, you know, when you grew up. And so it's something that is just part of your life. So you don't need to have somebody telling you what you have to do. It's just part of your experiences. So I didn't get any pressure from my father. And when my father saw that I had this passion for, you know, research and science, he said, okay, just do it, please, and go through, you know, specialization, go through courses all around, whatever you want to do. And at some point, then he said, okay, in the family business, we still need somebody that could be in charge of some special plans. So you don't need to be in the line. You can be on a staff. And this is what I made for, you know, let's say 5 years. And then the sixth year, he said, okay, you are the CEO. And so, you know, things changed.
So that was 1990, was it? You joined the business. And when did you become CEO? Yeah.
CEO was the beginning of 97.
Okay. Just quickly, because some people listening to the podcast won't know Campania. They'll obviously know of Naples. And if they're lucky enough, they'll have been to Naples and Pompeii and things like that. Just to give us a quick overview of the terroir, what are the major influences and the soil types on the styles of wine that you make?
Okay. We are in a region that, talking about latitude, is considered southern region. So people think of sun and the sea. Of course, it's beautiful. I mean, it's worldwide so well known. I mean, the Amalfi Coast, Sorrento, and Capri, Positano. Yeah. But we are in the inland, in a very, very cold wine region. We are in a high elevation situation, and our period of harvest, we are the last wine region to pick the grapes compared to any other part of Italy and probably any other part of Europe, because we finish our harvest in the beginning of November in a very, very cold environment. We start with the whites in mid-October, and then we end with the red Aglianico grape for Taurasi DOCG and the 10th, about November 10. So this makes a very peculiar condition. Because first of all, we got a huge freshness of these wines because we have a huge acidity. That is something strange, very weird compared to what is happening in the world of wine all around. But even if we make a late harvest, we still have a problem of excess of acidity. That is a good problem in this period.
Especially and, now, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And even if we go through 100% malolactic, we still have a huge acidity in these wines. So this means ageability. All the wines, the reds have a century perspective of aging, and the whites have a 40-50 years of aging potential. But then another characteristic is the volcanic soil. So we got a beautiful presence of ash in the soils, a huge richness in of course in minerals. So we got these very vertical wines that are salty. We don't want to have any residual sugar, of course, because we want to enhance the style and the character of these soils. We need to have a very sincere and true interpretation of our nature. And so we have this very, you know, sapid, salty wines. And in some sense, we got this beautiful, nose of flint, a little nuances of fumade that are extremely elegant, of course. But what is interesting is the ageability. These are really wines that can be aged perfectly for a very long time.
I mean, you're always making northern wines in the south of Italy, in a sense, are you?
Yeah, definitely. We are releasing now our top whites after 5 years of cellar and our top reds after 7 years of cellar.
Well, and you've mentioned the volcanic soils, and everybody knows about Vesuvius because of Pompeii. Are there other volcanoes in the region or not?
All the region is volcanic. We got volcanoes around, even in the inland of the region on the mountain side. We got some volcanic areas with ancient volcanoes there. So there is a huge influence of ashes all around. We got in all the stratification of our estates. We find all the time this layer of ash all around.
And are any of the volcanoes live? I mean, Etna, famously in Sicily, is still live, very alive. Are any of the volcanoes live where you are?
Vesuvio is still alive, and we've got some problem in the Flegrei area on the coast as well. But we still have an evacuation plan, that is always running in the Vesuvio area for all the population of the area. So it's not happening because the last big eruption was in 1944, but it could.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's worrying for you. Tell us about the grape varieties. You know, you've mentioned Aglianico, you've mentioned Fiano and Grillo and Falanghina a little bit. Are those the dominant grape varieties in the region? I mean, was what your father tried to do, did he win in a sense or not?
Aglianico, Fiano and Greco are the three main grape varietals for sure. These are the three DOCGs of the area: Fiano di Avellino from Fiano, Greco di Tufo from Greco, and Taurasi from Maglianico grape. Then we got a fourth grape that is Falanghina, that's very popular. It's a little more approachable in terms of organoleptic style character, because it has a little more fruity style compared to the mineral character of Fiano and Greco. So it's a good ambassador, because, you know, these are not, you know, extremely easy wines, approachable wines. But Falanghina is a good ambassador, because it's just a little more understandable to, you know, an international palate.
I mean, Fiano and Falanghina are sometimes called Roman grapes, and Greco and Aglianico are sometimes called Greek grapes, aren't they? Just tell us a little about the influence that those two civilizations, Greek civilization and Roman civilization, had on wine production in Campania. I mean, you can still feel it, can't you, in a sense?
Well, that's our treasury. That's our big, big patrimony here, because Campania in Roman time was called Campania Felix, Felix in Latin meaning fertile, because of the fertility of the soils. And we had the Greeks dominating in the Magna Graecia period, dominating all the basin of Mediterranean Sea. So they came from south, and they dominated from south the region. And the Romans were just moving from a city approach to an empire approach. And they started from Campania, so they started coming down from Rome to Napoli. So we had the fusion, the join of these two civilizations in the area. Pestum in Salerno province, but Pompeii as well. Pompeii is Roman, but is Greek as well. We got a Greek part of Pompeii that is not known at all, because the Roman part is over the Greek, and so they cannot make an excavation on the Roman ruins. But Pompeii has a Greek root as well. So we got in the region the Greeks bringing their grapes, their varieties, because their culture was made of wine, and so they wanted to bring not only the wines, but even the vines. And so they planted their vines in the region, and the Romans were excellent in technique, in training systems. So the Romans were able to enhance the characteristics of the grape varieties. So we were very lucky in this region, because we got, you know, on one side a patrimony of varieties that became wider. On the other hand, the possibility to give value to all this patrimony through the knowledge of the Romans. If you read, you know, Pliny the Elder and Naturalis Historia, you will find all the more modern techniques of vine training that were already known at the time.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you were involved with this project inside Pompeii. You've mentioned Pompeii. It's called the Villa dei Misteri. And I think this project started in 1996. And I think you stopped being involved in 2021. Just tell us about what you did, because, you know, didn't you find seeds in the ash, which led you to the grape varieties that you planted in Pompeii? Just tell us about those two grape varieties, Piedirosso, I think, and Sciascinosso, yeah?
Yeah, the project started in 96 with the first plantation of some of the vineyards, and the first blend of Villa dei Misteri was based on these two grapes, Piedirosso and Sciascinosso, because, of course, Pompeii is a very plain condition. It's at the sea level, so you don't have any elevation, and Aglianico needs to have much more, you know, cold and humid environment. But after some years of experimentation there, we started building some of the vineyards with Aglianico grape, with the training system that was the traditional alberello, the bush training system, that allows you to bring the bunches closer to the soil, so in a more humid condition. And so at the end, we were able to bring even some Aglianico to ripening. Uh-huh. And at the end, the blend starting with the 07 vintage became a blend of three grapes, so Aglianico, Piedirosso, and Sciascinosso. The problem of Aglianico is that when you grow it close to the coast, you harvest in the second half of September, usually around 18-20 of September, while here in Irpinia, in the inland,
it's November,
November 10. So, you know, consider how important is this project also to understand what is the reaction to the environment of these ancient grapes.
And what's the wine like? I mean, you haven't made it since 2021. And I think the current release is what, the 2014? So it needs time in bottle, does it?
Yeah, we are going to release the 14 in a while. The wine is very, very nice and mild compared to Taurasi. It doesn't have probably the strength and personality of a wine from the mountains, but it has a beautiful balance, and it still has the contribution of Aglianico in these last vintages. So it has, you know, the personality of Aglianico that helps a lot, because Piedirosso doesn't have the aging potential of Aglianico. Chachinoso gives us a color contribution. It's not really a strategic variety in the blend. So at the end, with Aglianico, it started being a little more impressive in terms of style and personality. The wine has a good ageability, not as ageable as a Taurasi, and it's rounder, a little softer because of the elevation, of course, because of the soils. We consider that the soil is completely different there, because the volcanic soil is completely black and is completely sandy compared to the wines that we have on the mountains, that are much harder and lighter in color and more on the chalky clay on the top. So it's a harder soil.
Hmm. Tell us about the different DOCGs. You've mentioned them already. It's got three DOCGs, which is the highest level, at least in theory, of Italian wine, isn't it? Which are Greco di Tufo, Fiano di Avellina, and Taurasi. Why are they different? I mean, they're all made from a single grape variety, I believe, or is Taurasi can be a blend sometimes, can't it?
They are, in the rules, they must be at least 85% of these grapes, and the 15% can come from other traditional grapes of the region. But I think that nobody are doing that anymore. So since the beginning of the 70s, about 50 years ago, there was a kind of a specialization of viticulture, and Greco di Tufo is based 100% on Greco grape, Fiano on Fiano 100%, and Taurasi on Aglianico 100%. So this is currently, you know, the big structure of the production. And the three DOCGs are one close to the other in terms of areas, one on the border of the other, but you don't have any contamination. So you cannot find any Fiano vineyard in the Greco area and so on. So the areas are a little different. The Fiano is a little wider, but with a little lower concentration of vineyards and a little more, you know, high mountains. And so you got vineyards that are in different areas. When you go to Greco area, it's smaller, but the concentration is much higher in terms of vineyards. So you find vineyards almost everywhere. And it's a little more hilly, not high mountains, and a little more, it goes on a river that is called Sabato on the two sides of this river. And it's a little closer in terms of environment. You've got much wilder nature. And when you move to Taurasi appellation, this is wider, and it's divided in four different parts. You've got another river there that is called Calore that comes all the way from the north to the south. The northern part is more hilly, with the very delicate hills and a little lower average elevation, so it's about 500 meters. And the climate, it's just a little milder, so usually you harvest about 1 week earlier. When you move to the southern part of the region, you go up on the mountains again, and the viticulture goes up to 650, sometimes 700 meters of elevation in a very cold condition with a lot of snow, and you harvest later, and the wines have a little more darker fruit, a little more stronger personality, a little less mildness and so on, a little less softness. So it's interesting to go through the different wine regions in these appellations to understand more about these wines.
Well, it's interesting because 700 meters in Italy would be very high for red grapes, wouldn't it?
Yeah, of course. And that's why we harvest so late. And you consider that Irpinia, our wine region, is one of the coldest and the most humid regions of the whole country here.
Yeah.
We got a huge humidity, and we have got a natural protection from the freezing currents coming from northeast, because we are right in the middle of a high valley with all mountains all around. And so it's surrounded by high mountains. This is an interesting protection. And that's why we are not being hit so strongly by the global warming process.
Yeah.
So that's why we still harvest so late compared to Tuscany, that are harvesting, in August, or Piedmont in early September. In 30 years ago, Nebbiolo was harvested in a period that was not so different from Aglianico grapes. Now it's totally different.
Yeah. You mentioned Nebbiolo, and Aglianico is sometimes called the Nebbiolo of the South. Is that a useful description, do you think, or is it a grape variety that expresses sight as faithfully as Nebbiolo does it? And does it deserve to be seen in its own right, not as a kind of copy of something else?
Well, this definition was used to point out the elegance and the finesse of the wine from the mountain like Taurasi. So Aglianico as Nebbiolo of the South means that you are using a grape that at the end will have in balance its first characteristic. So you don't have to expect from Taurasi a huge and over concentration and hyper powered wine. You still need to look for balance, finesse, and agility. Consider that the Taurasis of my father, that 61, 68, 58, 71, 77, the wines that really made the story of Taurasi worldwide, where Taurasi produced with a huge agility, with a very, very delicate touch, with a nice transparency, not an hyper concentration of the fruit, with a beautiful balance. This was the style of Taurasi. We are now producing, again, a Taurasi in that style that is called Stilema. It is exactly like that, with a little shorter maceration, with lower temperature, with a little less concentration, with a beautiful agility in the glass. This is probably the most interesting contribution to the image of Taurasi that we are doing nowadays.
You could really argue that the red wine revolution of the south of Italy, which covers now, Puglia and Sicily and Calabria and Basilicata, started with Taurasi, didn't it? That was the first kind of famed great wine of the south of Italy?
Yes. For sure, Taurasi, and particularly the label named Radici, that was a project of my father, of Antonio, that was that started in beginning of 1980s, and the first release of this wine was made in 86 and was a huge success and became fastly one of the best known labels of premium wines of Italy. Consider that last year our Radici Taurasi Riserva was classified as number 5 top wine of the world by the Spectator. So
that's
this
right.
Is something that has never happened to a
this
wine.
This is the Wine Spectator, south, yeah.
Yeah, Wine Spectator.
Yeah, yeah.
South of Montalcino never happened in the story of wine. So this is something that really makes us think that things are changing. Things are changing nowadays because, even in the international critics, there is an awareness of what is happening south of Italy with these beautiful personality and variety of characters of each territory with so unusual, diverse grapes that are expressing beautiful terroirs. And so I think that this is the most important contribution that my family gave to the world of wine, my father mainly, because really Taurasi is the image of the Renaissance and the revolution of Southern Italy. For sure,
of the south of Italy. Tell us a little bit more about the style of the wine, because you've got a fairly young team at the winery, haven't you? Your oenologist is Massimo Di Renzo. Just tell us, what's your approach? It sounds like it's a mix of traditional and modern, really. It's not just one thing or the other, is it?
Well, we think that if you want to be there 3 centuries, you need to be, a classic. And the classic is, a fusion of tradition and innovation, for sure. So we have a huge, very strong effort in experimentation, innovation in the winery. And we got a team of 6 people working every day with me to all this project. I mentioned Stilema, that is the most recent wine research plan that is based on 3 wines, but every decade has his plan of development and research on wine. So we got Radici that we mentioned in the 80s, but in the 90s we got Naturalis Historia and More Maiorum. I mean, every decade has its story of wines that change slightly the perception of the wines of southern Italy. And so, for us, this is extremely important. We need to have people that grow in the area, experiment many harvests in the same region, know the people, not only the soil and the environment and the climate. You know it. Terroir is something that puts together nature and social life. And so you have to be there. You cannot come from, you know, Australia or South Africa and make a deep and wide interpretation of what happens in the middle of nowhere. That is Irpinio, of course.
And you've got what now? I think 18 estates. So you're drawing grapes from 18 estates. I mean, obviously within the DOCGs, you don't blend things, but do you have different estates in Taurasi and different in Avellino, for example? Yeah. And Greco di Tufo?
Yeah, this is extremely important for us. We got different estates in each wine region. This allow us to explore and experiment the variety of the appellation area. As I mentioned before, these appellations, you know, don't express just one wine. In each of them, you can make different interpretation. You know, in Fiano area, you got some areas that are more on the stone soils, and you can express this kind of wet rock character. And in some other areas, you've got more flowery or may fruity style. And the same happens in Greco. In Greco, sometimes you've got some estates where you got this beautiful sulfur, you know, the nose that is outstanding, but you don't have it in the higher estates where you got much more a character of different minerals, more salinity, but a little less of the sulfur. So if you have the possibility to have different crews, and then you also have the possibility to do some very iconic blends, at the end, you got both approaches, that is territory and micro territory, and you really can testify what is that appellation.
Interesting. I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, you're a professor of business management here at the University of Foggia. You didn't mention the University of Foggia, but you're also an academic. Do the worlds overlap? I mean, is what you're doing at the university, is that more theoretical stuff, or is it hands-on, as we would say in English?
Well, of course, as I teach to the students of the first year, of course, there is a little more of a theoretical contribution. And also, I teach at the doctoral degree, so it's theoretical. But, you know, a businessman when goes through a class, it's difficult that he has only a theoretical approach. So in the language, in the approach to the classroom, in the practical experiments, in the project works that we do every course, I mean, of course, they understand that my language comes from the everyday life, from a decision-making process that is extremely, you know, concrete. And so
Running a business, you know, you're running a three-century-old business. I mean, you're also, you've written two novels and I think two books of poetry, and you're a painter, right? Does wine feature in the novels and the poems, or are they completely separate?
No, there is a fusion. One of the novels, there are some of the characters that write some of the poems that I publish in the other books. So, you know, there is a mixture of experience.
Are they winemakers or wine drinkers or anything like that, or not?
Some of them, you know, there is a business lady that is a wine drinker. And sometimes I use some examples, you know, of wines just to deliver a message during the story, you know. Yeah, it happens.
I must say, reading your CV and biography, it almost gave me a headache. You know, you're vice president of Federvini, you're president of the Istituto del Vino di Qualità. You're doing all these two main jobs, as you said. You're a professor, plus you're running this very, very famous winery, and you're sitting on all these various boards. How do you find the time to do all these different things?
Well, you know, time is a mental issue. It's not really a physical bind. It's just a matter of organization. And then when you've got more interests, each of them is a way to regenerate yourself from the others. So it's a good therapy at the end. Let me tell
you. I mean, are you very disciplined? You probably need to be, don't you?
I used to be, but now I'm getting older, so a little less.
And what do you spend most of your time doing? Is the winery the main part of your life?
It's the winery because I live here, because I enjoy every day, you know, the wine tastings in the cellar. That is beautiful, you know, the assembling and things like that, you know, the experimental part. So this is a big part of the job, but I spend a lot of time traveling, of course, on the markets. I travel all the time. Every month I got an international, intercontinental flight somewhere. So, I mean, it's something that I really have. I mean, my family has always been doing this for generations, but now the new generation, they love to travel. They are traveling with me now. They have been experiencing, you know, traveling all over the world already. But I'm sure that in few months they will start doing this job even without me. I hope so.
I want to ask you how you think Italian wine will develop over the next 50 years. Do you think the South will continue to evolve? I think the wines of the South, particularly what you're doing in Taurasi, but also maybe Etna and other parts of Sicily, maybe Basilicata, are increasingly seen as very important wines in their own right, aren't they?
Yeah, things are changing quite fast. I think that the most important, the biggest changes are coming from the South, from the production side, from the regions of the north, mainly Tuscany, Piedmont, and Veneto. We got many entrepreneurs that are much more, you know, commercial, much more marketing oriented than the people from the south. People from the south are now starting experiencing more and more understanding that they have to travel, they have to see, they have to taste wines from all over the world. They have to understand what is happening in the markets. They have to understand what is the consumer expectation more and more. This is what they are doing. That's why there is a kind of revolution. That's why things are happening in these regions, because there is a huge opportunity of development here. While in the regions that I mentioned from the north, I mean, many things have been made already. And so, you know, the improvement is a little harder there. Here we still have to do a lot, and that's why you see it, because every step is a big change.
Yeah, so there's still lots of potential to be realized in the south of Italy,
Definitely. That is made of awareness mainly, because the characteristics of the grapes and the soils and the environment are all there, but you have to exploit them, to enhance them, and to make this, to get this goal, you need to have more and more experience in the wine business, not only in your region, but also experimenting in, you know, different fields of research and comparison and dialectics.
And I think some people listening won't be aware of this, but Italy's got so many great varieties that many of the great varieties that are grown in the south are only grown in the south. I mean, you don't get Aglianico in the north of Italy, do you, for example?
No. I mean, they are all focused in their regions, and they are the expression of those regions, even if we are seeing in the recent past that some of the appellations, the big appellations of other regions, are introducing our grapes. Fiano is becoming more and more, they are introducing these grapes in their platform of varieties. Because, of course, you know, it's not very common to have a white grape that produces a white wine that can be aged 40 years. No. And, you know, yesterday I had a masterclass with five Fianos from different parts of the world. One was mine, of course, but then there was one from Argentina, one from California, one from Virginia, one from Australia, and the last one was mine. Okay.
And Sicily grows Fiano as well, doesn't it?
Yes, Sicily started in Italy to grow Fiano, but we got some Fiano in Apulia as well, and they are introducing some Fiano in Tuscany recently.
But it doesn't taste like your Fiano, right? It doesn't taste like your
Fiano. No, because it takes a couple of thousand years to get this kind of comfort zone for the grape.
Listen, final question is how do you get away from wine? Do you need to get away from wine? I mean, as you said, your bedroom, your life, your kitchen, your living room is full of the smells of wine. How do you get away from it? Is it writing? Is it painting? I know you like to ski and ride your motorbike. Are those the main escapes for you?
Ski. Also, I love the sea, boating. Mm. I love to play golf. I like to, you know, some sports, of course, but I don't need to have a kind of a shelter from wine, because I really feel it as something that doesn't give me any stress. I'm really relaxed, because my father was great in introducing me to business. He was a, as I said, a very strong, you know, character and personality, and he was very stressed by work. He was, you know, all the time, you know, struggling here and there. And probably this was the most important example for me to become something different. So I'm much more relaxed.
you sound incredibly relaxed, and I love your idea that time is a mental issue. And listen, Piero, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much, not only for your amazing English, but for sharing the history of your region and of your family winery. It's been fascinating for me, and see you soon.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, I don't know about you, but I learned a lot there. Listening to Piero really makes me want to jump on a plane to Naples. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is another Piero. Piero Incisa della Rocchetta, from Bodega Chacra in Argentinian Patagonia, to be precise. Join me then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.